Good morning. If it pleases the court, Nathan Cutler appearing on behalf of plaintiffs, appellants, Jeremiah Johnson and Chicago Building Design PC.
Hold up for a minute, counsel. We've got a lot of moving parts in the courtroom. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Cutler.
I apologize. We're here today on appeal from the Northern District of Illinois in a case involving several claims for copyright infringement for misuse of a set of blueprints. The two issues before the court today are, one, the appropriate equitable tolling standard to apply to the statute of limitations under the Copyright Act, and two, whether or not repeated ongoing use of an infringing set of blueprints by passing them to city officials for purposes of facilitating and passing annual inspections constitutes infringement under the Act. A claim for copyright infringement under Section 507 of the Act must be commenced within 3 years of the date the claim accrued. This court has interpreted the word accrued to mean that the statute of limitations begins to run when the plaintiff knows or reasonably should know of the infringement. This is an equitable standard called the discovery rule, which postpones the beginning of the limitations period from the date when the actual infringement occurred to the date when a reasonable plaintiff would have discovered that infringement. Inquiry notice is a separate standard, which says that the statute of limitations begins to run when a plaintiff begins to investigate the possibility that he has been injured. The Supreme Court in Merck versus Reynolds has unequivocally held that the two standards are different. Merck says that inquiry notice may have a place in the discovery rule analysis, but it's only to direct the court's attention to a date where a reasonable plaintiff would have undertaken investigation, but that the statute of limitations does not begin to run until thereafter the plaintiff discovers facts that will form the basis of the action, or a reasonable plaintiff would have known of the infringement. The district court in this case applied inquiry notice and entirely supplanted inquiry notice for the discovery rule for when the statute of limitations began to run. And the district court held that under inquiry notice, the plaintiffs in this case were clearly on inquiry in 2008 when an employee from Chicago Building Design, was at the City of Chicago offices and witnessed a set of blueprints that looked similar to the blueprints that plaintiffs drafted for the defendants.
I have a couple questions about the status of inquiry notice and what it actually means in the case law. Let me take the last one first. It seems to me inquiry notice is kind of a moving doctrine, for lack of a better way to put it. Sometimes it means that the statute of limitations starts to run whenever that inquiry notice date is. Sometimes it means that upon inquiry notice, the plaintiff has a duty of diligence to start investigating, but that date doesn't itself trigger the statute of limitations. Some date, based on a reasonableness standard, later is when the statute starts to run. And then under the Supreme Court's interpretation in Merck, inquiry notice really doesn't have anything to do with the start of the statute of limitations at all. All it does is inform the court's determination of how the discovery rule applies. And so inquiry notice really is not a helpful concept under Merck. Is that a fair summary of where the case law is at?
I think that in cases where courts use purely an inquiry notice standard, that the statute of limitations begins to run on the date of inquiry. In other words, if there are storm warnings, whether or not that inquiry was actually taken, if there are storm warnings that are revealed to a plaintiff, the plaintiff has a duty to undertake some investigation. I think...
So in that sense, inquiry notice is the same as discovery rule?
I'm saying inquiry notice begins the statute of limitations running when either a plaintiff undertakes an investigation or a reasonable plaintiff should have undertaken an investigation after receiving storm warnings of an injury or an infringement.
But discovery, the discovery standard, though, goes well beyond that, right? Not just storm warnings, but knowing or reasonably should know that, in fact, all the elements of a cause of action are present.
That's right? Correct. So
is it fair to say that this is a case in which that difference is critical? I mean, would you agree that the district court correctly ruled that you guys had storm warnings and were on inquiry notice in 2008?
I think that this is just the type of case where a plaintiff may have been under inquiry notice at one point. But
you did, in fact, start inquiring, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
The plaintiff, in this case, did start inquiring after the employee witnessed the blueprints and undertook extensive investigation to figure out what exactly happened, but that the plaintiff in this case did not discover, and a reasonable plaintiff should not have discovered until possibly the earliest date, May 8th, 2009, when the data warehouse report issued a permit based on the blueprints for a full build-out of the premises.
So to the extent that inquiry notice under the case law triggers the running of the statute of limitations, that's wrong. It's and inconsistent with the discovery rule.
That's correct.
We should overrule any case that says that.
I'm saying in copyright cases, what this court has done has consistently applied the discovery rule to start the statute of limitations.
But just as a general matter, the discovery rule applies as a general matter to statute of limitations cases, unless the statute itself says otherwise, right? In other words, unless it's a statute of repose.
I think that Congress can leave open for the courts to decide what equitable, in some cases, what equitable standard to apply to determine the beginning of a statute of limitations.
Okay.
All I'm saying is that this court has taken the Section 507 of the Act to mean that the discovery rule applies in copyright cases. So maybe in other types of cases, the appropriate or the standard adopted by this court is inquiry notice and not the discovery rule.
Mr. Cutler, can I ask you a pretty elementary question here? What exactly was the infringement here, as you all see it? Because as I understand it, the defense paid your client to draw up building blueprints, and I assume that under the contract they're entitled to use those.
They did not pay for those blueprints. They paid a portion of those blueprints. They then took those blueprints that the plaintiffs drafted.
I understand there's a big breach of contract issue in the case. Okay. But under the contract, you all prepared blueprints for them, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Apart from whether they're required to pay you guys under the contract, why aren't they entitled to use the blueprints for the intended purpose?
They are entitled to use them for the intended purpose.
So what did they do that infringed?
They modified the blueprints that were drafted by the plaintiffs by stamping another architect's name on them, giving them to another architect, and stamping another architect's name on them, and that architect claiming those blueprints as his own and filing them with the city of Chicago. Additionally, beyond that act, the defendants utilized those infringing blueprints in one of the major economic values of a set of blueprints, and that is the value of using those blueprints to pass annual inspections on an ongoing basis and keep the business's doors open to the public and reaping the profits from doing so.
Okay. Just I want to understand, though. as far as you're concerned, if they had just used your blueprints, hadn't put anybody else's name on them, they're entitled to do all those things, right?
They were entitled to use them to obtain a repair and replace permit. They were not entitled to, well, obviously, stamp somebody else's name on them and claim them as their own, or to use them to apply for subsequent permits.
I don't understand the latter part of that. I understand the first part. But the, why aren't they allowed to basically use it to keep the business open? And why doesn't the form contract say something about these issues? This is like a Coase theorem problem.
The standard in the industry is that the drafter of a set of blueprints retains ownership of those blueprints, and that's what happened here. The authority for the defendants to use the blueprints were to use them in that form and not to use them to secure other permits not contemplated between the parties. What they did was they stamped another architect's name on them and used them to obtain a full permit for the building and then repeatedly used those infringing blueprints to pass annual inspections. None of that was authorized.
Well, okay, let me just try to split that apart. Under the contract, assume it's paid, okay? They pay you for your blueprints. They use the blueprints to do a renovation project, and they keep those they file those with the city and use them to get annual to deal with annual inspections. Does any of that infringe your copyright?
No.
That's all contemplated by the contract.
That's correct.
It's all silent about that, but that's what you say is
contract. That's correct.
Okay.
As I was saying, the
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
I'll just save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Shelley Colwin on behalf of the architect, John Wilson. I'm also arguing on behalf of all appellees. Kimball Wood is at the table for the other appellees. Your Honor, the issue before the court, as you've noted, is this, at least the issue that's raised, is this alleged dichotomy between the discovery and the inquiry notice rule. We believe in this case that it's a non-issue. It's almost a difference without a distinction for purposes of this case and for purposes of the district court's ruling for two specific reasons. The first reason is that as this court has held in both the Guyman case and in the Taylor case, the discovery rule means that the statute begins to run when a reasonable person exercising reasonable diligence should have learned that their rights were being violated. Okay, that's the discovery rule. Now, the district court used this language about inquiry notice and storm warnings. The plaintiff asserts those are two separate standards, and what they say is all of the circuits under the copyright law have adopted this discovery notice. And the case that they cite to very heavily is the Third Circuit case of Graham versus Howey. That's their case. They say, look at that case, and there you have it. Nine circuits have said it's the discovery rule. So I encourage the court to look at that case, because what that case says is,
well, we have our own case law on this.
I understand, but my point is this. The definition of what reasonable diligence under the discovery rule has never really been addressed to a certain degree. And what the plaintiff says is, look at this case. This is a case that specifically says we're adopting, every circuit in the country has adopted the discovery rule for copyright law. And in that case, the court said, Third Circuit said, this is a case of first impression. Is it a discovery rule or an injury rule? Okay. And in defining the discovery rule, what the court specifically said was, applying this precept, this is the discovery rule, here, We ask whether the plaintiff should have known the basis for its claims, which depends on did they have sufficient information of possible wrongdoing to place it on inquiry notice or to excite storm warnings
for
culpable
activity. Yeah, that can't possibly be right because that equates the discovery rule to inquiry notice, which has not been understood, at least not been understood consistently in this circuit, to mean that the statute of limitations starts to run upon the date that the plaintiff is on inquiry notice.
My response to that, and I saw the dichotomy myself, my response to that is, in my view, apparently the court does not agree, but in my view, that is the further definition of what reasonable diligence means. When you see something...
Let's take a look at that question of reasonable diligence here. Frankly, one of the things that troubles me here is that this was decided on a motion to dismiss. It's an affirmative defense. Plaintiff didn't have to plead around it. And questions like reasonable diligence and inquiry notice in this context sound pretty fact-specific. Take, for example, what the plaintiff has told us about their efforts to try to get access so they could actually inspect the blueprints, and they're told no. And that sounds like a decent argument for reasonable diligence.
If they hadn't pled themselves out of court, Your Honor.
How did they plead themselves out of court?
It's interesting that you ask, and here's my response. In their complaint, what they say is, in paragraph 14, they say the they're...
Original or amended? Which
first amended complaint.
Okay, thanks.
I think that's at appendix 60. Mm-hmm. They say... Their employee went to the city and saw the blueprints. I'm sorry, they define the blueprints in paragraph 14. The blueprints that they define are the ones that they've drawn. Okay? Their blueprints. That's how they define that term in the complaint. Then in paragraph 31, they say, our employee went to the city in 2008 and saw the blueprints. Our blueprints. Our blueprints with somebody else's name on it. Modified. That's the very infringement that they're talking about here.
Should they have filed suit? Could they have filed suit
Absolutely.
On that basis?
Absolutely. Why couldn't they? They go into the building department. They see their blueprints. They see Mr. Wilson's name on it as his blueprints, modified. The infringement that they're claiming here, that they were just telling you about, is that Mr. Wilson modified their blueprints and passed it off on his own. And the only thing that happened after that was that it was given to the building department for zoning. And when they say, when they tried to plead around that in the First Amendment complaint, which they also, they made those same allegations in the first complaint. When they tried to plead around it, what they did is they tried to plead a continuing violation. And they tried to plead this reasonable diligence issue. So they started talking about, oh, we called up Wilson and we went to the professional regulation and all these things. But the reality of it is to do what? To get a copy of their own blueprints that they had already seen in the city of Chicago by their own definition in their own complaint? That's why it was resolved on a motion to dismiss. Because they, unusually I admit, pled themselves as follows in the First Amendment complaint. Blueprints means our blueprints. Sometime in 2008, more than 3 years before we filed suit, we saw our blueprints at the city with, in their complaint, Mr. Wilson's name on it, modified, infringing on our copyright, right then and there. Even if, that's why I said there's two reasons it doesn't matter, the second reason that we assert in our brief is, even if it's discovery notice and not inquiry notice, even if for some reason the district court used the wrong standard, okay, it matters not. Because if they didn't discover it, then what were they? What could their possible subsequent actions get them? They say they didn't know for sure until May 9th in 2009 when the permits were issued and they got their own blueprints back. They had seen their own blueprints in the city with Wilson's name on it. It's that simple. They did discover it right then and there. Their second argument is it's a continuing violation because, you know, Wilson gave it to the city for permits and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the law is crystal clear on that giving architectural plans to a building authority to obtain permits is a limited publication.
Well, that term only has import in the context of what the copyright holder does and the scope of the copyright holder's rights. In other words, that limited publication doctrine determines, or at least under the old law, determined the extent to which the copyright holder could make claims. In other words, waived the exclusivity by putting the work into the public domain. That concept doesn't have any applicability to the definition of an infringement. It just doesn't apply in that context.
I see the distinction that you're drawing, I think. I appreciate the distinction that you're drawing. That the argument that the plaintiff made was that the giving of the plans to the building department was a separate violation. And I think it does apply in copyright because what they're saying is that doing that is analogous to, in the Taylor case, selling more maps.
No, I think you're not understanding the distinction, and I'll take responsibility for not articulating it very well. The limited publication doctrine applies to the copyright holder. In other words, under the old copyright law, if the copyright holder published the works in a sense of releasing them into the public domain, then that would affect the recovery.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the limited publication doctrine arose in copyright law. A lot of that's been changed by the new copyright law, and it just doesn't have a lot of application. It has some, but not very much application anymore. It doesn't have anything to do with what constitutes an infringement.
Well, if that's the case, then perhaps, and maybe I'm wrong about this, it wouldn't be the first time, that then is it a case of first impression here as to whether or not under the new law, giving building permits, getting building permits with construction drawings by another architect is a separate infringement.
Is that distribution?
Is that distribution? It's never been held to be.
Why wouldn't it be?
Because distribution means you're using it to give to, in my view, the general public to make money off of it.
Well, the argument here, though, is this is the economic value of this work, right?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And this is how you have to use it. Assume wrongful copying. The copier might never distribute to the general public, but distributing it to builders and city departments, etc., that's how they extract the value of the copyright.
Except for one thing, Judge. In that situation, okay, when you're only giving it just to get zoning, okay, all right, they could have done that. I mean, and off the, outside of the record, because you would ask some questions about it, it isn't just a situation where Wilson took the plans, put his own name on it, and then started using them. The plans had to be modified because they were insufficient. That lies at the gravamen.
Well, that's a derivative works violation.
Okay, and right, and perhaps so, but my point is I don't think it's a separate violation because I haven't seen any cases.
Why do there have to be cases? I'm asking you as a matter of first principle. Why is that not a distribution or a derivative works violation? This limited publication doctrine just doesn't have any application here. So argue as a matter of first principles why that doesn't constitute an infringement.
Because I don't believe that simply giving it to a zoning department to get a permit.
Why not?
Because
that's the economic value.
But it isn't the sole economic value. The economic value that they got out of the blueprints is a design for the restaurant. That's what they wanted. They hired them to do a design. Time and time again, architects are hired. Draw this for me. I'll pay you for the blueprints. Give them to me. They're given. And then the architect leaves the scene. It happens all of the time.
So long as the purchaser of the blueprint
pays them,
and the terms of the contract, purchase contract, are...
But then you're turning it into an issue of contract law, with all respect, because what you're saying is, if they had paid them...
Right, but this is a copyright... there are contract claims here, but this is a copyright claim, and the claim is that the new architect passed them off with the city as his own plans.
And
why is that an infringement either as a distribution or a derivative works violation?
Because in my view, at that point, all right, They had purchased the plans. They belonged to him, to the defendants, the other defendants. They had every right to give them to another architect to modify them when they were, on their face, insufficient. Otherwise, what architects could do is they could draw poor plans that were insufficient to obtain zoning permits, get paid for them in full, and then another architect has to come in, modify them, and then as soon as they modify them, they get that payment, and then they can sue for copyright infringement.
Well, that may be a defense to liability that's separate and has not been briefed here, but to the extent that this was a distribution or a potential derivative works violation, it on its face, at least at the 12b6 stage, constitutes an infringement under the copyright law, because this idea of limited publication that the district court applied doesn't apply.
Obviously, I wasn't prepared necessarily to argue that case of first impression. I mean, the arguments that the plaintiff made, and I apologize for that, the arguments that the plaintiff made is that these are separate violations because they're not limited publications. Not that the limited publications doctrine doesn't apply here. They just argued this 1962 Florida case says they're not limited publications. The last case that looked at
right,
that
but
said...
But if you read all those cases, there are cases about limited publication by the plaintiff, in other words, by the copyright holder, not whether a limited publication by the violator somehow doesn't constitute an infringement.
Perhaps so. I see that my time is up, and while it's maybe a little bit unique to ask on that issue, because I don't believe that issue was before the court, whether or not this constitutes a separate violation outside of the limited publication doctrine, I'd ask to leave to file a supplemental brief. But thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Cutler. You have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. There was a lot of discussion about paragraph 14 of the amended complaint. The reason that the amended complaint states that those were the blueprints of plaintiff was not because the plaintiff knew in 2008 that they were the actual blueprints that they drafted for the defendants, but by the time we filed the complaint, it was obvious. That's why that was included in the amended complaint. In 2008, an employee happened to witness a set of blueprints which are exempt from disclosure under FOIA, which are not meant for the public's eyes, witnessed them at the City of Chicago offices, had a brief amount of time to look at them. They looked similar to blueprints that plaintiffs drafted for the defendants, but had somebody else's name on them. They could have been blueprints drafted by this architect, Wilson. It's not as if the employee has a photographic memory and can compare those blueprints to the set that they actually produce by taking them to the office and having as much time as they want to look at them. Their subsequent attempts to get the blueprints obviously were not fruitful. So that's why we're saying that it was essentially impossible for the plaintiffs to craft a complaint which would pass muster under the heightened pleading standards such as Twombly and Iqbal at that point. In 2009, when they had additional factual information, then maybe that was possible.
A whole new field of Iqbal discussion here as it applies to the statute of limitations. We've talked about this a lot among ourselves as well. So.
Okay. Inside joke.
And then I would just like to address one more thing. The blueprints, as was discussed, their economic value lies in a couple of places. One, securing construction permits or repair permits. Two, the passing of annual inspections for the building to keep the doors open to the public. They are sold from the architect to whoever purchases them, but they're not customarily, after that point, sold by the building owners to somebody else. So we're not talking about like maps and Taylor that are generally distributed or sold to the public. The only distribution here, really, could be distribution to city officials, which is exactly what happened.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.